This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. Indonesia has been hit by more deadly earthquakes, which have killed more than 380 people so far. Reuters' Michelle Hennessy reports.
The 7.5 magnitude quake hit Indonesia's Sulawesi Island at nightfall. It was the second quake to rock the region that day and triggered a tsunami with waves up to 6 feet high, sweeping through the scenic tourist town of Palu. On Saturday, local media showed military personnel loading cargo planes with relief aid to help victims of the disaster. The military chief says Marine Corps and Army health units are also being deployed. It's been a deadly year for Indonesia, which sits on the Pacific Ring of Fire, making it prone to powerful quakes. Dozens of villages were destroyed in the island of Lombok in August by a series of major earthquakes that killed more than 500 people.
That's Reuters' Michelle Hennessy reporting. President Trump is directing the FBI to launch a new investigation of his Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh at the request of the Senate Judiciary Committee.
I think it will work out very well for the country. I just want it to work out well for the country. If that happens, I'm happy.
Have you thought at all about a replacement for Judge Kavanaugh?
Not even a little bit. Not even a little bit.
Kavanaugh has been accused of sexual assault when he was in high school, and there are similar allegations from a college classmate. He has denied all of the allegations. A federal district court judge in Washington has ruled that a group of nearly 200 members of Congress have legal standing to proceed with its lawsuit against President Trump, whom they accuse of violating the U.S. Constitution by making profits on worldwide businesses he owns while he has been in office. Find more at voanews.com. This is VOA News. China may be targeting U.S. political action committees and various think tanks with spear phishing emails ahead of November's U.S. election. U.S. intelligence officials have been hinting for some time that China is poised to act more aggressively regarding potential interference in U.S. elections. The Committee to Protect Journalists says that reporters are being jailed in unprecedented numbers worldwide. More from VOA's Margaret Bashir at the United Nations in New York.
CPJ Executive Director Joel Simon told a press freedom event at the United Nations on Friday that the world body needs to raise its voice and name and shame countries that abuse reporters.
The jailing of journalists is a brutal form of censorship that is having a profound impact on the flow of information around the world.
The top three jailers of journalists last year were Turkey with 73 journalists jailed, China with 41, and Egypt with 20. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
Campaigners fighting for equal access to places of worship in India have won a key victory with the Supreme Court lifting a centuries-old ban on girls and women between the ages of 10 and 50 from entering one of the holiest Hindu temples in southern India. They said that treating women as children of a lesser god is unconstitutional. They saw in the second judgment in 2 days that has given a boost to gender equality in India. In a separate ruling, the court struck down a law that criminalized adultery, saying it discriminated against women. Facebook says millions of accounts have been compressed or compromised in a security breach. The latest from AP's Warren Levinson.
Facebook says the breach allowed hackers access to some 50 million accounts. They got in through a feature called View As that allows users to view how their profiles look to outsiders. The company doesn't know who the hackers are or where they are based, and it wasn't immediately clear whether third-party applications were compromised as well. Facebook allows its users to sign on to other applications with their Facebook credentials. The company, which has 2 billion users, reset about 90 million logins, including anyone who's been the subject of a View As search in the last year. Facebook doesn't know yet whether the hack had a specific target. Warren Levinson, New York.
And a well-known Chilean priest at the center of the clerical sexual abuse scandal in his country, Father Fernando Caradima, has been defrocked by Pope Francis. The Vatican has referred to the move as exceptional and carried out for the good of the church. The Maldives Election Commission has released the official results of last week's presidential election, confirming victory for opposition leader Ibrahim Mohamed Soli. The commission revealed Saturday that he received 58% of the vote. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Douglas Impuga, sitting in for Peter Clote.
Public morality offense, including indecent dress, discriminate against women and are limiting their movement and role in public life.
Outcry over Sudanese government's continued repression of fundamental freedoms and abuse meted out to women to keep them in line.
And so government has nothing to worry about when citizens decide that they want to be heard. Government has to get accustomed to hearing from citizens because, well, it serves as the pleasure of citizens.
Zambian civil society groups protest what they say is the government's poor handling of the country's financial resources.
The jailing of journalists is a brutal form of censorship that is having a profound impact on the flow of information around the world.
And the Committee to Protect Journalists says reporters are being jailed in unprecedented numbers worldwide. Those stories and more coming up right here on Nightline Africa. A UN human rights expert has described as deplorable the Sudanese government's continued repression of fundamental freedoms and abuse meted out to women to keep them in line. The report by the independent expert on the situation of human rights in the Sudan was presented to the UN Human Rights Council. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Aristide Nononsi says he welcomes positive developments taken by the Sudanese government in reducing tensions and military operations in conflict parts of Darfur. These include the collection of weapons used by various armed militia and criminals and granting greater access by humanitarian agencies to people in need. However, the human rights expert says he is very concerned by the large number of reports he receives regarding restrictions on political rights and fundamental freedoms, including freedom of expression, assembly, the press, and freedom of religion. He says Sudanese security forces reportedly use violence, intimidation, and other forms of abuse to silence women across the country.
Public morality offense, including indecent dress, discriminate against women and are limiting their movement and role in public life. Humiliating corporal punishment of lashing violate international human rights norms. In Darfur, sexual and gender-based violence remain a serious concern during the reporting period.
Nononsi says displaced women and girls are most victimized by conflict-related sexual violence. He says a climate of impunity in the country allows these crimes to flourish. The independent expert also criticizes government austerity measures, which he says have led to a deterioration of economic and social rights. He says it is critical for Sudan to address the root causes of poverty and inequalities to achieve long-term stability in the country. These criticisms did not sit well with Sudan's Minister of Justice. Mohamed Ahmed Salem says his country is making great progress in the sphere of human rights, which is reflected in a new constitution awaiting final approval. He says his country has taken measures to combat weapons trafficking and notes that Sudan's name has been withdrawn from a list of countries that recruits children in armed conflict. Over the objections of Sudan, the UN Human Rights Council adopted by consensus a resolution to renew the mandate of the independent expert to monitor the human rights situation in that country for another year. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Zambian civil society groups went on demonstrations to protest what they say is the government's poor handling of the country's financial resources on Friday. Organizers say the protest, which was held outside parliament, was also aimed to put pressure on the administration to fight public sector corruption as well as to sensitize citizens about the dangers of the country's staggering national debt. The protest came after police initially rejected the application of the civil society groups seeking permission to protest, but later relented and granted permission. Supporters of the government say the decision of the police to allow the protest validates the administration's tolerance and democratic credentials. For more about the protest, VOA's Peter Clote reached Lara Miti, one of the organizers of the protests in the capital, Lusaka.
When we were given the go-ahead, we thought, well, it was very short notice. We had less than 24 hours to plan it, to mobilize. But I think we pulled it off. We were at Parliament, as the members of Parliament and ministers were going into Parliament. And the idea behind the protest was to let it be known that citizens are very unhappy with the way public resources are being managed, especially the number of corruption scandals that keep breaking, that add up to millions and millions, billions actually, of kwacha lost from the treasury, lost to service delivery.
Was the objective of the Friday's protest achieved by the civil society groups that protested?
We think it was achieved, yes. So we had a good group of young people, especially, and the police, after initially trying to prevent us from going all the way onto Parliament Road, were forced to allow us because a group of ruling party thugs arrived with stones, trying to stone us. So when people scampered onto where we wanted to be, and so spent the rest of the protest there.
Civil society groups have often accused the government, and for that matter, President Edgar Lungu, of dictatorial tendencies. Supporters of the government say that the decision by the police to give civil society groups, in spite of the opposition, the go-ahead to protest is a demonstration of the government's democratic credentials. How do you respond to that?
I'm not sure about government democratic credentials. I think it's just we welcome it. I'm not sure that it goes as far as proving the democratic credentials, because, as I say, we had ruling party cadres come and throw stones at us. And then also it took us quite a while to get the go-ahead, which meant that we could not mobilize as well as we could. But, yes, a step in the right direction. And like we were saying, this protest was pulled off very, very well. It was peaceful. We were on the sides of the road. Yes, we were picketing, but we were allowing the ministers to go through. And at the end, we cleaned up after ourselves, did not leave any litter, and so government has nothing to worry about when citizens decide that they want to be heard. Government has to get accustomed to hearing from citizens because, well, it serves as the pleasure of citizens.
So what is next after this protest against the way the government is administering the country's purse? What is next now?
What is next is continued advocacy. For us, I think it is getting the ordinary people, the everyday Zambians on the street, to understand the link between public money and their everyday lives and the services that they enjoy. So what we'd like is a critical mass of voices of ordinary people asking questions and also putting enough pressure on government in order to ensure that government begins to manage resources accountably, but also to punish those that are found to have with their hand in the kitty and just outright corruption. Because as it is, government is very defensive about corruption. It can be in the millions of dollars, it can be in the thousands of dollars, it can be in billions of kwacha. And the answer is always the same. Those who say it's corrupt are the ones who are attacked. You're narrow-minded and that kind of thing, and you have an agenda. And I think we need to get government to be as concerned as citizens are about the amount of resources that are leaving the treasury through the back door.
But Ms. Miti, recently the president forcefully said that he has put in measures to fight graft in the country. People have been asked to present proof of the graft. Don't you think that he is doing what the population has been calling for to fight corruption? Because recently, in his public utterances, he talked about the fight against corruption that his administration has been undertaking.
Well, he does make the right sound once in a while, but it's never categorical. The president will say something like, "Well, we're putting these policies," but all those talking about corruption, of the agendas, they're just accusing people falsely. So it's very confusing. He sends mixed messages. It's never been categorical. There's never been a proper, thorough investigation about any of the scandals that have broken and are in the public sphere. So I think he says just enough, but does very little in terms of action.
Laura Miti, one of the organizers of the protests, speaking to my colleague, Peter Kilote. The Malawian opposition group United Transformation Movement, UTM, is legally challenging the refusal by the Registrar of Political Parties to accept its application to become an official political party. This after the Registrar expressed concern about inconsistencies in the application. The UTM says the move is part of the government's plan to prevent the group from participating in next year's general election. The reaction came after officials of the capital, Lilongwe, also rejected the UTM's request to campaign in the city Saturday. For more reaction about challenges facing the opposition group, my colleague Peter Klote reached UTM spokesperson Joseph Chanditi Malunga.
The registrar of political parties refused our party, UTM, to get registered. And there were a number of issues that they raised, including the fact that we didn't, you know, spell in full the abbreviation of UTM. But I think as a party, we believe that whatever the case, we should have been given a chance to be heard. Now, that being the case, our lawyers are taking up the matter, and right now they're filing, they're preparing documents to file a case in the High Court. And we believe that in the next few days, probably a date should be set for the hearing, and from there, then we'll see what the court decides.
So some are saying, why wouldn't the UTM simply amend or try to find solutions to what concerns the Registrar General raised in order to push ahead with your registration to make it quite simple and easy for you?
Well, this is a legal issue, and I believe that our colleagues with legal minds should be able to deal with this issue. And as we speak right now, they contain the situation, and there are all sorts of options out there that they are going to look at. So probably that is one of them. So we'll see what happens maybe after tomorrow or the other day.
Supporters of the ruling party have so far denied that the ruling of the Registrar General was politically motivated, like some supporters of the UTM are saying. What do you say to that?
Well, I mean, what else do you expect from them? I mean, they can deny anything. They deny anything to do with UTM. We know that this is coming from them. Right now, UTM is the biggest threat to all political parties in Malawi, and therefore they can do anything to stop UTM from going ahead. And another development just today, they're denying us from conducting a rally, a political rally in Blanta Saturday afternoon. So again, another plot to try to stop UTM from going ahead. So that's why we're saying that all this is politically connected. It's political persecution. We know that this is coming from the ruling party, but we're going to deal with it. Like I said, our legal minds are working on it, and we should get over it very soon.
But Dr. Chitandi, some are saying that this is not the first time a breakaway faction from the ruling party has taken the country by storm, only to flame out ahead of elections. And they predict that UTM will suffer similar fate. What makes this assessment untrue in your case?
This is different, my brother. Right now, Malawi is at crossroads. If you follow politics in Malawi, in 1992, when we changed from one-party system to multi-party system, it was the same situation when people were just tired, people wanted change. And right now, it's exactly the same situation as we were in 1992. People are tired with what is happening right now. People are tired with poverty. People are tired with corruption. People are tired with tribalism, all that. And that's why they believe that the UTM is the only political party that can actually, take them from what we are right now into what we want Malawi to be. So we are at the crossroads right now. I mean, we're not going to go back. And everyone, if you talk to Malawians out there, whether within the country or outside the country, they will tell you the same thing, that we are tired and we need something. We need change right now. And change is inevitable. Nobody is going to stop it. Yes, they can try to delay it, but nobody is going to stop it.
Silas Chilima, who leads the UTM, the current sitting vice president, who has accused the government of endemic corruption, among other accusations, some say has been hypocritical because the ruling party or the government gave him the opportunity to provide his evidence against the allegations of corruption that he keeps on stating. And so far, he has yet to do so. That makes the whole movement not credible at all. Your take?
Well, it's not over yet. We still have probably like 7-8 months to go before elections. So watch the situation and see what is going to happen. But otherwise, we believe that we have enough evidence to take everyone else to task. So just watch the situation.
UTM spokesperson Joseph Chanditi Malunga speaking to my colleague Peter Klote. Scientists have managed to wipe out a population of mosquitoes in a laboratory using a type of genetic engineering known as a gene drive. The intervention prevented the females from reproducing and caused the entire population to die off. Scientists hope the method can be transferred from the lab to the real world to tackle mosquito populations that spread diseases like malaria, as Henry Ridgewell reports.
Mosquitoes spread malaria, which kills an estimated 429,000 people every year, many of them children. So this new method of killing a mosquito population has sparked huge interest. Scientists from Imperial College London managed to eliminate a population of breeding Anopheles gambiae mosquitoes, the species that carries the malaria parasite, in a laboratory using a gene drive. Professor Andrea Crisanti co-led the research.
The gene drive is a technical solution that allows a genetic modification to be spread from few individuals to an entire population.
That modification involved disrupting a gene that determines sexual differentiation.
So in this way, a genetic female, if you destroy this gene, cannot develop into a female, but develop in something between a male and a female that we call intersex. These individuals cannot bite, which is very good, cannot lay egg, and so cannot reproduce itself.
That inability to reproduce spread across the mosquitoes, and the entire population died off within 11 generations. The big question is whether that success can be replicated outside the laboratory. Again, Professor Crisanti.
We've already done, we've moved this mosquito in large, confined space which mimic completely the tropical environment. Then after this is completed, this phase will also be crucial to gather a lot of information for regulatory purpose, for example, about safety, stability, ability of the gene drive to move across the species.
Scientists would not want the modified gene to spread to other mosquito species and wipe out too many of the insects which birds, frogs and other animals depend on for food. Right now, testing is limited to the laboratory, with tests in the wild not expected for another 5 to 10 years. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
The committee to protect journalists says reporters are being jailed in unprecedented numbers worldwide. At the end of 2017, 262 reporters were detained for their work. VOA UN correspondent Margaret Bashir reports that harassment of journalists is not limited to authoritarian states.
The top three jailers of journalists last year were Turkey with 73 journalists jailed, China with 41, and Egypt with 20. CPJ Executive Director Joel Simon told a press freedom event at the United Nations on Friday that the world body needs to raise its voice and name and shame countries that abuse reporters.
The jailing of journalists is a brutal form of censorship that is having a profound impact on the flow of information around the world.
One case in the spotlight is that of Hua Lone and Kwa So U in Myanmar. The two Reuters reporters were detained last December while they were investigating the mass killing of Rohingya Muslim men and boys in the Rakhine State village of Andine following a military crackdown. British barrister Amal Clooney represents the two reporters. She says the Myanmar authorities did not want their story about the massacre at Andine to come out, so they set a trap for them.
So police planted government documents on the journalists while other officers lay in wait outside to arrest them. The journalists were arrested and were then prosecuted and subjected to a show trial in which their conviction was guaranteed.
They were sentenced to 7 years in prison for violating a state secrets law. Clooney said they are seeking a presidential pardon in Myanmar for them, as it is the only way to win their freedom. Reuters President Stephen Adler says this is a chilling warning to other journalists.
Myanmar is not the only country where attempts are made to deter investigative news gathering, scare sources and whistleblowers, dim the spotlight of reporting, and thereby allow officials to act in darkness with impunity.
The North America director of Reporters Without Borders, Margot Ewan, told the panel that there is a growing hatred of journalists worldwide, and it is not limited to authoritarian regimes.
We are seeing democratically elected regimes also attack the press more and more frequently, which is why we need to continue to address wrongs as they occur publicly.
U.S. President Donald Trump likes to refer to negative news coverage of him and his administration as fake news, and reporters at his rallies and during his campaign reported encountering hostility from his supporters. The Committee to Protect Journalists says at least 3 U.S. journalists have been arrested this year and 34 last year. At least 24 others have been assaulted, shoved, or had their equipment damaged. And in June, 5 people were killed in the newsroom of a Maryland newspaper. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
Scientists in South Africa have found that bacteria commonly found in women's vaginas in the country could explain why they are at higher risk of being infected with HIV than women elsewhere. South Africa has the highest HIV epidemic in the world, with more than 7 million people known to be living with the virus. The state says most new infections are occurring among women aged 15 to 24. For VOA, Darren Taylor reports.
HIV experts from the Center for the AIDS Program of Research in South Africa, or CAPRISA, have shown that relationships between older men and young women are driving epidemics across the continent. The women, mostly in their teens and early 20s, are poor and become involved with men who are on average 9 years older than them. The men are more likely to have steady incomes and so provide the young women with basic necessities such as food. But the men, who are generally between the ages of 25 and 35, also have high rates of HIV and pass it on to their young lovers.
This age disparity is the reason why Africa has 70% of the global HIV epidemic.
CAPRISA director Professor Salim Karim says this motivated him and other scientists to investigate why young women in South Africa are so much more vulnerable to getting HIV than any other group.
Are they having so much of sex? Well, the answer to that is no. In fact, all of our research shows young girls have very little sex. If they're having sex once a month, that's a lot.
So in the light of this, the CAPRISA team asked itself, why are so many young women in South Africa getting HIV? After a study involving 120 infected women, the answer they've come up with is because of genital inflammation.
They simply get HIV after a few acts of sex because this inflammation enhances their risk of acquiring HIV.
Karim says of all the 3,500 organisms present in the vagina that the scientists isolated, only one was common to the women who had genital inflammation.
This is our big new discovery. Basically, we showed that an organism, a bacterium called Prevotella bivia, is the main culprit. It increases your risk of HIV about 19-fold. This bug has a strong association with genital inflammation.
He explains that the Prevotella bug releases a molecule that helps HIV establish itself in cells.
Probably accounts for 40 to 50% of the HIV we see in young girls.
Karim explains that when younger women have intercourse, there's a lot more reaction in the vagina when compared with more sexually experienced women.
The younger you are, the more likely you are to have this inflammation when you have sex. It's just part and parcel of your body just reacting naturally to what it's supposed to be doing.
What isn't natural, though, says Karim, is that so many young women are being exposed to men with high viral loads because the men don't know they have HIV and thus aren't on treatment. That, plus the overabundance of Prevotella, is leading to spiking levels of HIV infection among young women in South Africa.
It increases your risk multiply. We don't know how much.
Medical scientists say the Prevotella bug is present naturally in women all over. Normally, it's kept under control by other good bugs that ensure the environment in the vagina is too acidic for Prevotella to thrive. But among women in South Africa, this isn't the case, and the bacteria are occurring at extremely high levels. At this point in time, Karim and his team don't know why this is happening, but they're probing a number of possibilities, some related to maintenance or lack thereof of vaginal hygiene. Until they have hard evidence, though, they won't be able to solve the problem, and the biggest HIV epidemic in the world will be getting even bigger. I'm Darren Taylor for VOA News in Durban.
You are listening to Voice of America, and this is Nightline Africa. And coming up in the second half of the program, our Saturday music spot from our collection of music from across the continent. And it's now time for our Saturday music spot. Yes, time to relax and enjoy great African music.
Baby, it's so fine. I drink it down one by the man. Baby, it's so fine. man, we're stuck here. You don't know. Are you ready now? Your children.
boys them a jumping. The way you jiggle and wiggle it on your front end. All you do is make them confused. Hey. Some of them them a shouting. Hey. There's a things them a see them a doubting. Hey. It's all about you breaking the rules.
Go. Obi Antone Coalition.
Nah.
Yeah, be Obi Antone Coalition.
What else?
For day.
Huh?
Obi Antone Coalition.
With.
Be Antone Coalition.
Ah, ba.
Obi Antone Coalition.
Nah.
Go.
Yeah. Mama won't be able to be a bonfire. I hope a promo yen yin abu huntia. Or ya were time for jar no manivia. Yam wamu a moonsina boompia. Go!
Se wupe muan yo men yin aedi. Nana nyamini awakano nebebe mo. Se wuma usaswa
be born in a tutu. So my party don't lose God, can't walk on my door, yeah. Everybody sing it, hallelujah. Yeah. Hallelujah. Everybody sing it, hallelujah. Yeah. Hallelujah. Make me sing, oh.
Fisa me shiase me koya masamba che aho chire kakra me fa munti ne wo mose ma wai me ni dama weni ne wuo no na mo fisa me yesanseni che uhumi ana wo ye ma che wo afede weni bo me so pe na gose hwanponi na ne nyame ne nsa no afede wo humi tutu mana mo se me ye jonki ne sabusu bu kebi shame on you too afede me hu se me makobole yonki che no kene ne musa monkey. If I check, I dey see you dey hungry. Why you yank about that social busky? Me woo ya de nane nyame tiase. Wone me nye pe wo bia ni ni viase. Mana me da bank so wa fla wono wo bia for handkerchief from the pemeni ase.
Se wo pe mo an yo me ni na edi.
What else?
Nana nyame ni ya wakano ne bebe mo. Kwe wo ma wo sa swa bi po ni na tutu.
So my body don't lose God, can't walk on my door, yeah. Everybody sing it, hallelujah. Hallelujah. Everybody sing it, hallelujah. Hallelujah. Make me sing, oh. Oh, yeah. I say, make me sing, oh. Chim 10 years, me wank a way back. My flop it, this be my payback. My enemies if for day God, men care so I don't want to disobey God.
No.
My try some of them to prison. Wa bra mu ni particular reason. Mo dwe me ho, me need to go for your meeting. Fatu wasum, I don't wanna be repeating. Nyame na ebo me ho ban ti munye foko. Money no be problem, ga no ni me moto. To when you hear me ho na me ni, let me shut to. Me mo me ninja, what you na me don't know.
When I wo boss run assassin, e munya menti na ye frawo Adonai. In your mama wire, mama ni me busia funa so many be brenti, I won't lie. When I wo boss run assassin, e munya menti na ye frawo Adonai. In your mama wire,
Baba God, Baba, you be too much, Baba God, Baba, you be too much, Baba God, Baba, you be too much, Baba God, Baba God, Baba God, Baba God,
Baba God, Baba God, Baba God, Baba God, Baba God, Baba God, Baba God, Baba God, Baba God, Baba.
So my body don't lose God, can't walk on my door, yeah.
That was our Saturday Music Sport. I sincerely hope you enjoyed the music. Netland Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. From the rest of the Netland Africa team, we thank you for joining us tonight, and I hope you join us tomorrow, Sunday. I'm Douglas Impoga in Washington.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The Democratic Republic of the Congo will hold an election in December, hopefully leading to a peaceful democratic transfer of power for the first time in the country's history. Sitting President Joseph Kabila came to power in 2001, having succeeded his father, Laurent Désiré Kabila, after his assassination. Joseph Kabila was elected president in 2006 for a 5-year term and re-elected in 2011. Though his second term ended in 2016 and the DRC constitution prevents him from seeking a third term, elections were not held and Kabila remained in power. Following protests in September 2016, Kabila's ruling party and the opposition signed an agreement known as the Saint-Sylvestre Agreement on December 31, 2016. The agreement paved the way for elections, prohibited Kabila from running for re-election or changing the constitution, and committed the DRC government to a number of confidence-building measures intended to create the political space necessary for credible elections. In November 2017, DRC's National Independent Electoral Commission finally announced for December 23, 2018. Many feared President Kabila would nevertheless attempt to run for an illegal third term, but those fears were allayed on August 8th, the deadline for registering presidential candidates, when the DRC government spokesman announced that Kabila would not seek re-election. In the Democratic Republic of Congo, the ruling coalition's announcement of a consensus candidate, other than President Kabila, represents a significant step forward for Congolese democracy, said State Department spokesperson Heather Nauert in a written statement. We are encouraged by this sign that Kabila intends to uphold his commitments to the Congolese constitution and the terms of the December 2016 St. Sylvester Agreement by not seeking a third term. Government, opposition, and civil society leaders, along with the heads of the security services, share with President Kabila the responsibility of ensuring full respect for democratic norms. The Congolese people must be free to express their views and choose from the candidates without fear of violence, threats, or intimidation. We call on DRC's National Independent Electoral Commission and Congolese authorities to take the necessary steps to guarantee credible elections on December 23, 2018, said Heather Nauert. The DRC has an historic opportunity to ensure a peaceful transfer of power in December, and the United States looks forward to supporting this process in accordance with the established electoral calendar.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.